Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
I'm Leo. And tonight we have a lot of news for you. We have some union issues, but coming up here, I guess this is like a couple of days. I can't remember exactly what day Kennedy was shot. I think it was the 23rd, 22nd of November. Do you remember?
22nd and 23rd,
it was
right before Thanksgiving.
Yeah, it was right at that time. But anyway, Kennedy said, there is a plot in this country to enslave every man, woman, and child. Before I leave this high and noble office, I intend to expose this plot, he stated. And John F. Kennedy stated that 7 days before he was assassinated. Isn't that amazing, folks? Yeah. Now here's another culprit, if you will.
Next time someone says Hillary Clinton 2016, remind them of this.
Right.
U.S. Ambassador Christopher Stevens was raped, tortured, and cattle prodded and burned to death for 7 hours while Barack Obama
and Hillary Clinton ignored his pleas for help.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that sick?
I didn't realize he was tortured.
I didn't either, but that's what happened. That's why it makes it so horrible. And you want, and you know, these idiots, these
burned to death for 7 hours.
Horrible people want Hillary Clinton to be president in 2016, and Obama should be tortured himself, you know, for the horrid crap that he allowed. No, it's amazing.
For a single person in Georgia to qualify for low-income Medicaid, they must make less than $2,820 a year, because a $50 per month grocery bill and $185 in monthly rent is all a person really needs.
We're in blue in Georgia.
Oh,
so,
God.
So much for Georgia. Yeah. There's some horrible things going on. One fascinating thing is 2011 deaths. Okay. This is statistics.
For the year?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. No, listen to this. 323.
That's in 2011.
Yeah. 2011 deaths. 323 were by rifles. Okay. 496 were by hammers. 650 were by knives. 12,000 were by drunk drivers. And 195,000 were by medical malpractice.
And it says you are 600 times more likely to die by using your Obamacare than by a semi-automatic rifle.
So feel sick. Isn't that something? They want to ban guns. Okay, they should be banning doctors, right? Pharmaceuticals. Fighting. Anyway, let's move on.
80% of the people in U.S. prisons have never caused harm to another person.
The U.S. has 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's
prison population.
Isn't that amazing, folks? I think that's extremely important to understand. And
the State Department is The State Department is offering a $10 million reward to find out who's responsible for Benghazi. And a woman says, "Hillary Clinton. Where do we collect?"
Yeah, that's exactly who's responsible for it.
It's a very sick thing that happened.
Yeah, and McDonald's is closing all restaurants in Bolivia. The nation rejects fast food.
Good for them.
Isn't that interesting? Hey, you got to hand it to these people.
This is from Get Holistic Health,
yeah,
by Lance Johnson. McDonald's fast food. I can't see that.
Sorry,
McDonald's happy image and its golden arches aren't the getaway to bliss in Bolivia. This South American country isn't falling for the barrage of advertising and fast food cooking methods that so easily engulf countries like the United States. Bolivians simply don't trust food prepared in such little time. The quick and easy mass production method of fast food actually turns Bolivians off altogether. 60% of Bolivians are indigenous population who generally don't find it worth their health or money to step foot in McDonald's. Despite its economically friendly fast food prices, McDonald's couldn't coax enough of the indigenous population of Bolivia to eat their Big Macs, McNuggets, or McRibs. One indigenous woman, Esther Choke, waiting for a bus to arrive outside a McDonald's restaurant, said, The closest I ever came one day when a rain shower fell and I climbed the steps to keep dry by the door. Then they came out and shooed me away. They said I was dirtying the place. Why would I care if McDonald's leaves Bolivia? The fast food chain remained for a decade despite losses every year. The 8 remaining McDonald's fast food shops that stuck it out in Bolivia's city of La Paz, Cochabamba, and Santa Cruz de la Sierra had reportedly operated on losses every year for a decade. The McDonald's franchise has been persistent over that time, flexing its franchise deep pockets to continue to do business in Bolivia. Any small business operating in the red for that long would have folded up and left the area in less than half the time. Even as persistent as McDonald's was in gaining influence there, it couldn't continue operating in the red. After 14 years of presence in the country, their extensive network couldn't hold up the Bolivian chain. Store after store shut down as Bolivia rejected the McDonald's fast food agenda. Soon enough, they kissed the last McDonald's goodbye. Deep cultural rejection. The McDonald's impact and its departure from Bolivia was so lasting and important that marketing managers immediately filmed a documentary called Why McDonald's Went Broke in Bolivia, featuring cooks, nutritionists, historians, and educators. The documentary breaks down the disgusting reality of how McDonald's food is prepared and why Bolivians reject the whole fast food philosophy of eating. The rejection isn't necessarily based on the taste or the type of food McDonald's prepares. The rejection of the fast food system stems from Bolivia's mindset of how meals are to be properly prepared. Bolivians more so respect their bodies, valuing the quality of what goes into their stomach. The time it takes for fast food to be prepared throws up a warning flag in their minds. Where other cultures see no risk eating McDonald's every week, Bolivians feel that it just isn't worth the health risk. Bolivians seek well-prepared local meals and want to know that their food was prepared the right way. This self-respect helps Bolivians in processed, restructured, and technology, often used by fast food joints like McDonald's, helps Bolivians avoid processed. I missed a word there. The McRib, 70 ingredients all restructured into one. Did you know that the McRib, I don't think I've ever had that, is processed with 70 different ingredients, which include azodicarbonamide, a flour leaching agent often used in producing foamed plastic? McRibs are basically restructured meat technology containing a mixture of tripe, heart, and scalded stomach. Proteins are extracted from the muscle mixture, and then they bind the pork trimmings together so that they can be molded in a factory. The McRib is really just a molded blob of restructured meat, advertised and sold like fresh ribs. There's nothing real about it. The preparation of the substance, of this substance. In fact, McRibs really came about because of a chicken shortage. The restructured meat technology approach kept the McRib on the menu despite the shortage, and the profits continue rolling in.
Wow.
This is a very disgusting idea that the Bolivians have rejected.
Good for them.
Yeah. I didn't know that it wasn't a rib. I mean, I've never had it.
Yeah, well, I had it years ago, and then they stopped making it. And then then they came out and they said how it was made with styrofoam. You know, same stuff that made a styrofoam. And I said, whoa. That was back, 10 years ago, you know?
I don't know. I've only been in McDonald's a handful of times.
Yeah, amazing.
Less than a handful.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah.
I've never liked it. I wouldn't eat there. I had a salad.
Yeah.
And even that was
lousy. Yeah.
And once when the power was out, I had to go there, and that was lousy. It wasn't
even
real.
Remember that?
It wasn't even real food.
Executive Order 13603. Google it. Executive Order 13603 is unconstitutional. Under Executive Order 13603, everything you own can be taken away under the guise of national security. This order rips our Constitution to shreds. One person is all that's power. We are really living...
Are we really living as free people, or are we really living under a dictatorship? Was it not more than 70 years ago that an ugly, short mustache man did the same thing in Europe? I leave you with one burning question. What is the real purpose of this executive order?
Right. 13603. Imagine that. Imagine that. That's right, folks. That's what he did. Ah, that's so sad. What's happening here? It really is. I mean, Obama is becoming a dictator, and everybody's going, yo, most hard-hitting GMO report ever aired by mainstream media. So let's listen to that for one second. Yeah? I thought it was kind of interesting. I posted it. It's really amazing.
So this is from Collective Evolution?
Yeah.
I don't know this.
All right. During what is possibly the most hard-hitting GMO report ever aired, by mainstream media, Max Goldberg states, no long-term studies have ever been done on humans. But when you look at the studies that have been done on animals, it's pretty appalling. You're talking about liver damage and kidney damage, and when they fed it to hamsters, the third generation of...
hamsters with
what? Yeah, wait a minute. The third generation of hamsters weren't able to produce babies. So they're real safety issues. Well, to alternative news reporters and readers, this might not be news information. It is rare that the mainstream media has covered the topic with such openness. The hard-hitting discussion between Carol Alt and Max Goldberg aired on Fox's The Healthy You program. Is this another positive step toward in raising awareness about the dangers of GMO? I hope so. Goldberg's statements reflect...
Can we turn that on? It's the audio.
Yeah, okay. For genetically modified plants, corn, soy, canola, and cotton. I hate to see... You know...
In my third book, Easy Sexy Raw, I wrote about the Doomsday Project. The Doomsday Project, or the Vault, as it is also known, is an air-conditioned bunker where the Norwegians have stored heritage seeds, billions of them. Why did they do this? Because they're afraid of what's going to happen to life as we know it due to the introduction of genetically modified foods, also known as GMOs. Well, that's their solution to this growing problem. But what can we do about it? I didn't know, so I turned to my friend Max Goldberg for answers. Hi, Max. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
So, what is a GMO? What is a genetically modified food?
GMO stands for genetically modified organism. Basically what it is food made in a laboratory. Until the last 20 or 30 years, this is food that has never existed before in humanity. So it's made in a laboratory, and more often than not, they're inserting viruses or bacteria into these plants.
Why do they do that?
They do that because GMOs were designed to sell more chemicals. So when they spray chemicals on the plants, they don't want it to kill the plants. They want it to kill all the everything around it, whether it's weeds or pests, and that's why GMOs were designed.
So basically, genetically modified organisms are bug resistant.
Exactly. The plants are resistant to the chemicals.
All right, so why are they so bad for our health? You really seem to hit on that point.
Well, no long-term studies have ever been done on humans, but when you look at the studies that have been done on animals, it's pretty appalling. You're talking about liver damage and kidney damage, and when they've done fed it to hamsters, the third generation of hamsters weren't able to produce babies. So that's the real safety issues. But the real big issue in our country, Carol, is that genetically modified foods are not labeled. So people do not know that they are eating genetically modified foods. Now, over 60 countries around the world require GMOs to be labeled, but the U.S. does not. And why is that? According to the Food and Water Watch, the ag biotech industry, which owns all these GMOs, has spent $572 million on campaign contributions and lobbying to make sure that they don't get labeled.
What's the ag?
The agriculture biotech industry.
Right. What is that?
So these are the companies that design these genetically modified foods, but these are the companies that also sell the farmers the chemicals. So they're not only just selling them the seeds.
They're selling them the chemicals that go along with it.
Exactly.
But you know what question pops up in my head? Aren't these people also eating this food?
Well, it's a really good question. I don't know if they're eating it or not. I would doubt that they're eating it, but they'll tell you they may be eating it. I'm not sure what they're eating, but you know and I know that people who really care about our health, we're not eating them. And so the mass population is being fed these foods, but they're not being informed that they're eating these foods.
Wow, this is heavy. So we've got this genetically modified organism that is not real food because it's made in a petri dish, that is being sold all over the world, that is coming onto the market, and they're not being labeled.
They're not.
So we don't even know whether we're eating them or not.
Exactly.
I am seeing some things that come up, like my popcorn said on it, no GMOs. So some are labeling it when there's not genetically modified organisms in it. What can we do to get them to label, to let us know what we're eating?
Well, there are movements in approximately 25 states right now. The biggest one was last year in California, but the opposition, who did not want GMOs to be labeled, spent close to $50 million to defeat this measure. And the one going on right now is in Washington state. They're spending about $20 million to defeat this measure. Why are these companies spending so much money to not disclose what's in their product?
Especially since 90% of the people in the country actually want these labeled.
Exactly. Polls consistently show that more than 90% of the people want GMOs labeled. And here's the craziest thing. The U.S.
And if that wasn't crazy enough, go ahead.
Here's the U.S. Patent Office gives patents to these genetically modified.
So a patent on food.
Yes, they have a patent. So they say, you get a patent because it's unique and different. Yet the FDA says, no, genetically modified food is no different than non-genetically modified food. So the FDA says it's the same thing, and the U.S. Patent Office says it's unique and different. And it's one of the real injustices in our country that GMOs are not labeled.
Wow. So how can we get them labeled? What do we have to do quickly?
Well, we have to, you know, constantly ask our politicians to support GMO labeling.
Write to your senators, write to your congressmen.
Yes.
Have your voice heard.
Absolutely. We need people involved. Continue to buy organic food because organic food, GMOs are prohibited. Buy non-GMO products. And really, people need to be involved because if we don't have our voices heard, nothing's going to change.
Max, thank you so much for coming on and pointing out this important problem that's happening. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
There you go, folks. That's what's going on. You know,
it's really
pretty sad. Scary stuff. It's really sad. And that was Fox News. I mean, they're beginning to trust Fox News more and more.
Every once in a while, they bring up something that we really need to hear.
Yeah. Well, since we're on the idea of health, let me go to this. Ginger root kills ovarian cancer. Isn't that interesting? Prostate cancer cells. something down.
Hmm. This is from worldtruth.tv. It's kind of frozen, though, there. Maybe that's all we're going to find out.
Well,
oh,
there you go.
Oh, no.
Oh, God.
It's not really coming through.
Yeah, something's happened sometimes like this.
You better get out of that site.
Let me try this one more time, because I think we got a little strangeness going on. Okay, let's try it one more time. I think it's an important article.
No.
Hang on. Okay. Ginger root kills ovarian and prostate cancer cells better than chemo. Yeah, that's amazing to me. Chemo kills everybody, you know.
It's not going to come through.
Yeah, we're getting a double image. Yeah, that's too bad. Okay. Alright.
So that's something to just maybe think about.
Yeah. As we get into the union issues tonight, I wanted to... One of the tragic things that I heard...
The U.S. is ranked 34th out of 35 developed nations for child poverty.
Isn't that disgusting?
Sick.
I mean, that is really absolutely horrible. And everybody in the United States is, oh, we're such a wonderful country, you know. We're so wonderful.
For some people.
Yeah, you know, for some people we are. But for
a lot of people,
60 million people, we're not, you know. It's really a frightening situation.
When you think of all the people that are incarcerated,
you know, it's really quite frightening.
When they could be doing community service stuff, but they just, you know, keep the prison industrial complex going by incarcerating nonviolent people.
Or they hire
them
out for,
slave labor.
For slave labor, it's really funny. Really amazing, and really sad.
See what's happening on with the AFL-CIO.
A little bit awkward here, a little slow, and they're moving slowly.
We'll go to their blog.
Slow.
Dreamers take arrest. Protesting GOP in action on immigration reform, how to block democracy, Republican style. I don't know what happened. Twice this year, in January and July, Senate Republicans promised to rein in their unprecedented use of the filibuster in Senate rules to block President Barack Obama's nominees. Twice this year, they have broken that promise and have fallen back on their obstruction tactics they've employed since Obama took office. He probably can't get anybody appointed.
He's got to do holiday appointments, you know.
That's why the Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, may bring up a measure to reform Senate rules and guarantee executive branch and judicial nominees an up-and-down vote without having to hurdle the 60-vote barrier Republican filibusters have placed in their path. So recently, Senate Republicans have blocked votes on three nominees to the U.S. Court of Appeals of the District of Columbia Circuit and have blocked Obama's nomination of Mel Waters, Secretary of Federal Housing Finance Agency. The District of Columbia Circuit is extremely important to working families, said AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka, when the three were nominated in June to fill longstanding vacancies on a court dominated by Republicans.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, it's really quite sad when you think about what's going on here. I wanted to mention tonight, everything is changing in the systems. Sorry, folks. Hang on one second.
So you bumped out of Facebook?
Yeah, I bumped out of Facebook.
So let's go back to, so that's what's happening, their filibuster.
Part of what's happening, part is, we're getting bumped out of everywhere. Security, everything is changing on these things, security.
The real reason Detroit went bankrupt. As the story goes, the city of Detroit went bankrupt because of $18 billion in long-term debt, in a large part caused by pension and health care benefits. A new report written by Wallace Turberville and released today from Demos says that the narrative is inflated, inaccurate, and irrelevant to explaining the city's bankruptcy. Despite what the city's emergency manager, Kevin Orr, who was hired by Governor Rick Snyder, says, the $18 billion figure is not relevant to the city's bankruptcy. To emerge from bankruptcy, according to Chapter 9 of the U.S. Bankruptcy Code, Detroit only needs to address its class cash flow shortage, a number that even Orr sets at only $198 million. But that number, much like the $18 billion number, is inflated because it goes with an extremely aggressive assumption for economic trends that are very unlikely to represent what really happened. When projecting costs, governments often create several projections, often reflecting best-case scenarios, worst-case scenarios, and some moderate position in between those two. Governments usually choose the moderate option in order to determine their budget projections, or Turberville says, has chosen the worst-case scenario and isn't at all based on certain liability that the city will face. Furthermore, Orr includes in that total nearly $6 billion of debt from the water and sewage department as a city liability, despite the fact that this liability is based on an area much broader than the city. The department covers 3 million people in southeast Michigan, not just the slightly more than 700,000 people who actually live in Detroit. Turberville notes that the city's operating expenses have declined by 38% since the beginning of the Great Recession. During that same time, the city's pension obligations only rose by $2 million. Healthcare expenses increased by 3.25%, less than the national average of 4%. The biggest proportion of increased costs for the city actually come from debt service and financial expenses related to complex Wall Street investments that amounts to more than pension and health care increases combined. Other key components of the city's deficit are a significant decline in the revenue base, because of the declining population, a decline of $67 million in state revenue sharing with the city, as much as $20 million annually in corporate subsidies that have provided questionable benefits to Detroit. The report concludes, Detroit's bankruptcy is, at its core, a cash flow problem caused by its inability to bring in enough revenue to pay its bills. While emergency manager Kevin Orr is focused on cutting retiree benefits and reducing the city's long-term liabilities to adjust the crisis, an analysis of the city's finances reveals that his efforts are inappropriate in important ways, not rooted in fact. Detroit's bankruptcy was primarily caused by a severe decline in revenue and exacerbated by a complicated Wall Street deal that put its ability to pay its expenses at great risk. To address the city's cash flow shortfall and get out of its bankruptcy, the emergency manager should focus on increasing revenue and extricating the city from these toxic financial deals. So instead of going where the problem really is, just blame poor working people and steal their pensions.
Gee,
you shouldn't have worked for 50 years and put money away for your retirement, right?
So
we need to take that.
So Bank of America can screw you.
I tell you, senators, today it's time to raise the minimum wage.
Yeah.
I agree with that. especially when they're collecting turkeys for people who work at Walmart.
Yeah, which I hope to get to, because I was really upset that my I got cut off.
And that was actually in Clinton, Michigan, that was happening.
Was that where it was?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because it really upset me that I got burned out here for some reason. I don't know why. You know, I got spiked 3 times this afternoon. Spiked. Yeah. Amazing. But for those of you who don't know what spiked means, that means I got clobbered by one of the offline.
I wonder why that was. What were you doing?
I was just looking up the stuff for our show. Definitely.
I think we've gone through most of it.
Yeah, we have. No, it wasn't there. I wanted to get to the Walmart thing, if you don't mind. Each year we spent $2.66 billion subsidizing profits at Walmart because they refuse to pay their workers a living wage. Well, take action and find a Black Friday protest. All right. Each year, taxpayers spend $2.66 billion in government safety net programs for Walmart employees because they aren't paid a living wage and need help. That means we're paying $2.66 to subsidize Walmart profits. Imagine that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Hang on a second. I want to get there. There's one down here. Here we go. Okay. Yeah, Walmart is holding canned food drives for its own underpaid employees. That's pretty sad.
Mm-hmm.
Downside. When the company is asking charity to pay its own, you know, its own people. Hey, come on.
The employees
are asking. Please donate food items so associates in need can enjoy Thanksgiving dinner. The Walmart.
Oh, I thought it was in Michigan. A Walmart in Northeast Ohio is holding
right.
a holiday canned food drive for its own underpaid employees. Please donate food items here so associates in need can enjoy Thanksgiving dinner. A sign reads in the employee lounge of a Canton area Walmart. Corey Lumberg, a Walmart spokesman, says the drive is a positive thing. This is part of the company's culture to rally around associates and take care of them when they face extreme hardship, he said. Indeed, Lumberg is correct that it's commendable to make an effort to help those who are in need, especially during the holidays. But the need for a food drive illustrates how difficult it is for Walmart workers to get by on its notoriously low pay. The company has long been plagued by charges that it doesn't pay its employees a real living wage. In fact, Walmart's president and CEO, Bill Simon, recently estimated that the majority of its 1 million associates make less than $25,000 per year, just above the federal poverty line of $23,550 for a family of four. When the Washington, D.C. Council passed a living wage bill requiring Walmart to pay workers a minimum of $12.50 an hour, the chain threatened to shut down its new stores if Mayor Vincent Gray didn't veto the bill. Gray vetoed the bill. Walmart's low wages come at a public cost because low-income workers still need housing and health care. Taxpayers end up doling out millions in benefits to bridge the gap faced by many of the store's retail workers. They have also led to strikes at Walmart stores from Seattle to Chicago to Los Angeles in recent weeks. Even if the canned food drive successfully gathers enough to help out the Canton store's low-income workers, many of them might not even be able to have the food on Thanksgiving, That's because Walmart is one of a group of retailers that will open its doors for Black Friday sales beginning 6 p.m. on Thursday, on Thanksgiving afternoon.
Isn't that sick?
Yeah.
Isn't that the sickest thing? I just found it to be so sick. So, oh boy. Dow Jones hits six unprecedented height Monday, crossing 16,000 points for the first time in the S&P's 500 index. It also on track to see its best year since 2003 and surpass $16 trillion in market value for the first time ever after a steady six-week rise in nearly every stock. While this year's robust market growth is great news for Wall Street, the average worker is seeing little benefit. Because the wealthiest 10% hold 81 to 94% of all stocks, bonds, and trust funds and business equity, the stock market wealth rarely touches the wallets of the lower 90%. In fact, the stock market post-recession rally actually drove income inequality by expanding the net worth of 8 million wealthiest households, while the other 111 million households rank wealth shrank. Meanwhile, the share of the economy going to workers' wages has sunk to a record low. According to one recent study, wages stayed flat or declined for the bottom 60% of workers from 2000 to 2012. Job growth may have improved on paper, but most of the jobs added in the recovery are low-wage, temporary, and concentrated in the service and retail industries. Sky-high corporate profits feeding off increased worker productivity on lower wages and fewer employees have thus far helped insulate the stock market from this reality. The congressional hijinks over the budget have strained this illusion. Sequestration cuts hit consumer spending with GDP growth hard this year, and House Republicans continue brinkmanship after the government shutdown has spurred widespread uncertainty among consumers and Wall Street investors alike. Just a few hours after hitting Monday's record highs, the market wavered above the release of a National Association of Home Builders, Wells Fargo Housing Market Index, finding that the home builder confidence flatlined this month, as prospective home buyers are holding back because Congress keeps pushing critical decisions on budget, tax, and government spending issues down the road, according to Chairman Rick Judson. Okay? So, anyway, it's not good, folks. I mean, you know, this is all euphoria, you know, the 6,016,000 point Dow, you know what I mean? It's just, this makes me scared. Makes me scared. Anybody talk about, this woman really bothered me when she said this, but You see this everywhere. You see Oprah going crazy over Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see every black person in the United States, not every black person, but every black leader now is coming out.
Has to line up behind it.
Yeah, trying to line up behind Obama and Obamacare, even though it's falling apart. And they're calling racists. Everybody who disagrees with them is a racist, you know. Like, you know, it's really sick. Texas Democrat Sheila Jackson Lee says Obamacare isn't forcing anyone off their insurance and says health care cancellation letters are lies. She's out of her freaking mind. All right? On Friday, Congresswoman Jackson Lee
told National Review
that she believes Obamacare is making American health care better, not worse.
Now, how does she know? Because no one can get it yet.
No, because she's an idiot. That's why. All right. On Friday, the Texas Democrat explained she doesn't think insurance companies are being honest with their former clients by sending them cancellation notices Instead, Lee thinks insurers should be sending people letters that say, "We're going to improve your insurance." Here are a handful of quotes she gave a conservative journalist at National Review. She said, "The cancellation notices were not the truth. It should not have been. We intend or expect to modify our insurance. Cancellation is what happens when you don't pay a premium or something that happens in the bad old days." Okay. A cancellation notice was the inappropriate document to send without notice. All they had to do was send that. "This is a notice to say that we're going to improve your insurance, not, in essence, eliminate your insurance." Imagine that.
Oh, they improved it by...
By canceling it.
By canceling it, or
yeah,
by doubling your or tripling your premium.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, this woman is sick out of her mind, you know? Okay.
Really?
Well, you know, if you didn't think that things were bad enough, and if you still love Obama, all right, then here's something for you. Okay? The new executive order gives Obama...
We just read that.
No, we didn't.
We just read that.
Where did we live? When
we just did a few minutes ago.
No, we did not.
Of order about taking people's property. We just read it.
Oh.
We did. We just read
minutes
ago.
Well, I don't think we read about this.
We did. It's the same one. It was a shorter statement, but it's the same.
Well, let's continue, because this statement says that Obama Friday...
That's the same thing that we read.
Okay. I don't think so. Okay. All right. Lila says we reread it.
Who is guilty of the bigger fraud, Bernie Madoff or President Obama?
Okay. Bernie Madoff defrauded thousands. President Obama defrauded America.
Mm-hmm. True. He's not been telling the truth.
If the president of an insurance company promised what Obama promised, he'd be behind bars.
They doubt it.
Well,
they buy their way out.
Bernie's behind bars.
Yeah, well, that's because he stole money from
his own people.
His own people. That was his mistake.
He stole money from his Jewish friends.
Yeah, shouldn't have done that, Bernie.
Bernie. Bad news. Bad thing to do.
Just taking it from others, not from them. Payback's a tough, Bernie. You don't take it from your own people.
Yeah.
Obama doesn't feel that way.
No, he doesn't care. He doesn't take it from anybody.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I can't even take it anymore. I can't take it anymore, folks. I'm reading stuff that makes me sick. Yeah. Christy, Clinton virtually tied a new 2016 poll, if you can believe that. I mean, I can't believe that anybody would go for either of these horrible, horrible candidates. It just makes me sick to my stomach to think that this could happen.
Just yesterday, NBC News released a poll that showed New Jersey Governor Chris Christie trailed former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton by 10 points in a hypothetical 2016 matchup. But in a new Quinnipiac University poll released today, the two are virtually tied. Yeah, right.
Listen,
I can't even read it.
I know. And according to Quinnipiac data, 43% of Americans would back Christie, while 42% would back Clinton. However, women favor Clinton over Christie, 48-39%, and men favor Christie, 47-35%.
Well, when you put up nobody else, what do you expect?
Well, you get two horrible schmucks, horrible, all right? You know, you got a fat woman and a fat guy, okay? Clinton has far better advantages over some other possible Republican contenders leading both Senate, Rand Paul, and, I mean, my God.
Paul Ryan?
Yeah, and Ted Cruz.
Ted Cruz.
I mean, you got crap. You got absolute crap running for 2016. And while the poll did not pit Vice President Joe Biden against any specific Republicans, it did ask respondents if they thought he would make a good president. Well, 54% of the people think Clinton would make a good president. 49% think Christie would make it. Would.
Only 25% of the people said they felt the same about Biden.
Yeah, the only person on this list who voters felt would make a worse president was Cruz, who came in at 24%.
Mm-hmm.
Quinnipiac University surveyed 2,545 registered voters nationwide. NBC spoke to 1,003 adults on November 7th to 10th, meaning that all of the calls in both polls came after Christie's landslide election day victory. If anything, these two desperate polling, disparate polling results demonstrate after how hard it is to gauge voter intention 3 years before an election. Yeah, they won't even be around. I swear they won't even be around. Try that.
Yeah. How are you calling this too old?
Well, no, she's sick. Benghazi, after Benghazi, I mean, what she did with Benghazi, you know, let that poor guy
endured.
Get killed, you know, Jesus. Well, under U.S. occupation, Afghan opium industry surges to record levels.
We've been reading things about that for the last
month. Well,
it's
short.
It's the same thing that we said last week.
No, we didn't say this last week.
Yeah, we did. We talked about
this. We didn't say this last week.
We did,
Leo.
We did.
We did. We read this thing last week?
We read another article all about the same thing.
We did.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we read another one?
Let's
be like the mainstream media, repeated 300 times in a half hour.
Yeah.
All right. The cultivation of opium poppy in Afghanistan, a nation under the military control of U.S. and NATO forces for more than 12 years, has risen to an all-time high, according to 2013 Afghanistan Opium Survey. Yeah. According to the report, cultivation of poppy across the war-torn nation rose 36% in 2013. The total opium production amounted to 5,500 tons, up by almost half since 2012. This has never been witnessed before in the history of Afghanistan. Fueling the ongoing military conflict in the country, the opium epidemic has also spurred a growing crisis of drug addiction in Afghanistan. Wow. This is Tunisia for our country.
No, this is a tsunami for our country,
tsunami, yeah.
Said Ahmed Fawad Osmani, the director of drug demand reduction. The director of drug demand reduction for, that doesn't even make sense, the director of something,
yeah.
Maybe he's a drug czar,
yeah.
Demanded reduction for the Ministry of Public Health. An interview with the New York Times. The only thing our drug production has brought us is 1 million drug users.
Wow.
Yuri Fedotov, executive director of UNODC, called the overall findings of the report sobering and warned the situation possesses a threat to health, stability, and development inside Afghanistan and across the region and beyond. Let's jump down here.
The drug problem is not taken. Yeah, okay.
Just go to the bottom. Though the opium industry is well known to help fuel the insurgency against the U.S. and NATO military forces, most opium farmers in Afghanistan continue to say it is simply the only way they can make a living. Meanwhile, despite having spent billions on eradication efforts in the country, the U.S. military has allowed poppy cultivation to continue in order to appease farmers and government officials involved with the drug trade, who might otherwise turn against the Afghan Karzai government in Kabul. Fueling both sides, in fact, the opium and heroin industry is both a product of the war and an essential source for the continued conflict. is high sale price continued to be the most important reason for cultivating opium poppy cited by farmers in 2013, as it was in 2014. High income from little land, improving living conditions, and the provision of basic food and shelter for the family were other important reasons cited by farmers.
There you go, folks.
So, they need the money.
They need the money, and we need the drugs. Everybody needs a drug, you know. If there wasn't a demand, there wouldn't be anything. Okay. Well, that was last week.
Mm-hmm. We ran out of them.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Okay. I forgot where I was going here.
Why don't we go to David Icke? There might be go to that site, because we've exhausted this one.
We've exhausted our postings.
You don't have to go all the way back up to
episode. Well, I wonder if I missed it here.
No.
I guess not. Okay. It's amazing. It's just amazing. Okay. So anyway, folks.
Just text out of this and go to...
I will. Hang on, babe. Layla and I are moving along here.
We're going to go up one. No, up, down. Down. No, you just keep going by. Keep.
I saw it. I got it. I got it. Everything takes a second when you're on the internet.
Mm-hmm. They want to put value added tax on food in England?
No problem. England's got more problems than we do.
Mm.
We don't know.
TSA rolls out detention pods at airport terminal exits.
Look at that.
The TSA is funding the rollout of exit pods. What is that all about?
Tubes that you got to get into. Across the country, they temporarily detain passengers before they are allowed to leave. Another example, critics say, of how the federal agency's police policy is treat travelers as prisoners.
Let's play that. It's only 1 minute and 47 seconds.
Yeah.
What is this all about?
After people get off a plane, the new airport exits are getting some strange looks. Look like a science fiction intergalactic time machine. I was expecting to get transported somewhere like on Star Trek. I thought, yeah, we finally got there. Others were wondering if it was an X-ray chamber or might fill up with dollar bills like on a game show.
Yeah, it was odd. I'm like, where'd they come up with this? I'm not sure what it is.
Are you still automatically?
The voice giving instructions is futuristic, but the new exit portals are just part of the Syracuse Airport's $60 million renovation. To keep the passenger area secure, passengers leaving enter the portal, wait for one door to close, and then the other one opens. The portal is one way. If anyone tries to get back into the secure area, the door automatically locks.
We need to be vigilant and maintain high security protocol at all times. These portals were designed and approved by TSA, which is important.
Syracuse is one of the first airports in the country to have the new portals. Previously, the exit was monitored by police or security guards. Syracuse's airport commissioner says the new portals should also save money in the long term.
The more cost-effective we can become, the more attractive we are when the airlines are looking at new markets or increasing service.
The exit portals can hold up to 6 people at a time. Although that's a little too close for comfort for a lot of travelers.
Oh, it looks very big.
I know. I felt like I needed to go in alone.
Syracuse may be the first airport in New York State to have the new exit portals, but the airport commissioner said they will likely be showing up at airports around the country very soon. For now, reporting from Hancock Airport, I'm Alex Dunbar.
They didn't explain.
Yes, they did. They said they used to have TSA agents there, and now they don't need to.
Yeah, but why?
Cost-effective, that's what they said.
Cost-effective what? Are they zapping them?
No, you're not listening. They don't have to hire people to stand there. They're using this system instead.
Well, what's the system doing?
Preventing people from rushing out. They must be doing something. I would have the feeling I was being zapped with something.
Yeah, one says, reminds you that you are captive and are meant to make you feel like a prisoner. You can't leave. Prison inmates feel of the devices complement numerous other TSA policies which critics have charged serve other purpose than making travelers feel like they are under constant suspicion. Last week, the Government Accountability Office investigation revealed that TSA's $1 billion chat down program has been a complete failure, and that it is no better than chance at identifying genuine security searches threats.
Well, chat down? What are you talking about?
It's a new program they got, chat down. Right? While threatening to arrest passengers who make jokes about airport security, the federal agency has also instituted a ludicrous freeze policy whereby travelers are ordered to stand in place like statues while TSA agents resolve some unexplained security threat. Another policy that has provided questions is...
Provoked questions.
...is the TSA random testing of passengers' drinks for explosives after they have already passed through the security and purchased drinks inside the secure area of the airport. I mean...
It's kind of ridiculous.
This is just, total insanity. What's going on here, folks? Total insanity.
Crazy. Black Cat Class.
Einsatzgruppen.
Special paramilitary task forces. Whatever that is. 10-year-old British girl explains to her teddy where money really comes from and it ain't the Bank of England. Scientists believe that animals, including humans, have a collective consciousness.
I believe that. The idea of a collective consciousness was first presented by French psychologist Emile Durkheim in 1893. Well, Durkheim's definition related more to a shared understanding of certain morals and social norms based on people either imitating others, exclusively passing on these behaviors to one another, or agreeing certain ideals and more in order to feel accepted. And in the 1970s, scientists began to suggest this collective consciousness could not be developed and spread through species non-exclusively through telepathic or supernatural means. The hundred monkeys phenomenon, for example, was an idea put forward by South African zoologist and ethnologist and was scientific author and colleague Lambert, 75. Watson and Blair used the behavior of Japanese macaque monkeys to back up their claim. It's like every, 99 monkeys, the 100th monkey takes on the same behavior, whether he knows what he's doing or not.
Go ahead.
Just got along.
Yeah.
We're at the end.
It was
of the
kind
show.
Of a fun thing.
Yeah. So anyway, once 100 people decide on what they're going to do, then everybody does the same thing, same kind of thing. So anyway, folks, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. I'm going to try to have a show tomorrow night, so hope you join us then. And in the meantime, thanks a million for joining us tonight, and have a pleasant evening.
Yeah, good night, folks. Thanks for being with us.
Good night, everybody.